Thank you for the introduction, and I would like to stress that I'm speaking here to you as a historian, not as an artist or philosopher. Artists are absolutely free to create myths and do think the Russians call it mifatvorchestvo. I'm a historian, and so I keep to historical facts. Nikolai Fyodorov's project of universal salvation and Russian cosmism. Let us imagine that one day technical and social progress will make paradise on earth possible, that realm of freedom of which Marxists dreamt. Man is no longer exploited by man. All the springs of wealth will satisfy all material needs. There are no diseases and genetic defects, and human life can be extended as desired. In this perfect society, all humans are brothers. But what about the fathers? What about those who helped create this paradise, who suffered and died without partaking in the fruit of progress? The question of whether there is such a thing as progress at all, considering the ever-growing number of victims, has occupied Russian writers and philosophers since the early 19th century. Famously, Ivan Karamazov voiced a radical rejection of a future harmony whose soil has been manured with the suffering of innocent people. For him, this harmony is not worth the tears even of one abused child. Not to mention the hell that reigns on earth and which is supposed to become even worse in the other world, so as to compensate for the sins of this one. For him, for Ivan Karamazov, this price is way too high, and he hurries to return his entrance ticket into such a harmony. In the early 20th century, thinkers like Nikolai Berdyaev, Sergei Bulgakov, and Vladimir Aron criticized the idea that a kingdom of freedom might be possible in this world, at the end of a continuous progressive development of humanity. According to Bulgakov, all previous generations gone forever, it would be not harmony, but in the best case, a few generations that would manage to achieve the end goal of historical progress, the dubious fortune of being able to enjoy the bliss of a socialist state of the future built on the bones of ancestors. Seen like this, the promise of a kingdom of perfect justice and bliss within the limits of history is an illusion. It is unrealizable because there is death. Death not only makes the life of an individual time-limited and random, hence devoid of value and meaning, it also destroys the unity of humanity by dividing it into generations. The division into generations makes it impossible for everybody to achieve the end point of progress, so that the sacrifices and efforts made throughout history remain meaningless, the results of no importance to all humanity. For Bulgakov, Berdyaev, and some other thinkers, the solution of the problem was in the resurrection of the dead, all of them. Only belief in this possibility, modeled on the resurrection of Christ, made possible an idea of progress whose end goal is, and this point is of crucial importance, beyond the realm of secular history. But does Christian belief in resurrection and eternal life really offer consolation? To speak with Ivan Karamazov again, what becomes of harmony if there is hell? Once again, humanity is divided in those who are blessed and those who are damned. And this time, the division is forever, so that the bliss of some would mean an extension of the suffering of others into infinity. A great number of surrogates were called upon to salvage the idea of progress in this world. Enshrined forever in the great heart of the working class, or lying mummified in the mausoleum on Red Square, the martyr, the red hero, lives on, even if only metaphorically. But where will the traces of the individual be preserved? Where will the individual be commemorated when the sun is no longer shining and the human species itself is no longer there? When this happens, the individual will not even have existed. However numerous the attempts to salvage the idea of progress in the face of suffering, death, and inevitable decay, however hard one tries to justify the sacrifices, ultimately, there is nothing one could call a satisfactory solution. This was exactly how Nikolai Fyodorov, a humble librarian of the Rumyantsev Museum in Moscow, saw progress in a world where there is dead, as a triumph of the young over the old, of the living over the dead. For him, this kind of progress was deeply objectionable. The highest goal of all human efforts must be a world without death, or more precisely, a world in which death will have never existed, so that everybody, including the dead, would be able to become part of it. In his Philosophy of the Common Task, Fyodorov appeals to all the living, the sons, to come together in a brotherly fashion in order to work towards overcoming death with rational, that is, scientific and technical means, and to physically bring back from the dead all the dead people. The petrification, otsetvorenie, which is gradually progressing, imminent resurrection of all previous generations, comes in place of childbearing, which only produces mortals and thus perpetuates the meaningless cycle of birth and death in a state of blind natural decay. Fyodorov describes the physical restoration of dead people as a completely mechanical and materialistic process that consists of tracing, collecting, and synthesizing the dispersed material particles of their bodies. The product will be a pure work of art, художественное произведение, created rather than begotten, and thus perfect and imperishable, even if the question of personal identity remains unresolved. In their search for the ancestors' ashes, prach priedkov, humans will free themselves from the shackles of gravity which stand for decrepitude and death. No longer idle passengers of the Earth, they will transform their planet into a spacecraft that will serve them in their exploration of the vastness of the universe, so they can use the infinite cosmic space as living quarters for the generations they will have brought to life. They will rebuild the universe, fill it with reason, and perfect it. In order to make their way through the universe and to be able to exist in all its worlds, humans will have to acquire the ability to create their own bodies, that is, to synthesize them from the elementary cosmic matter. Fyodorov never tires of repeating, our body must be our work. Наше тело должно быть нашим делом. Because only in this way would humans ever be able to gradually transform themselves from perishable natural creatures to self-regulating, independent, artificial entities. Humans will no longer be forced to transform the ancestors' ashes into nourishment for themselves and their progeny. Instead, They will learn to use those very ashes to reconstruct their ancestors with the help of the knowledge and practical abilities they will have learned through mastering the art of constructing their own bodies, tela starenie. The cannibalistic suppression and devouring of the fathers will be replaced with their conscious reconstruction. Love of parents will replace sensual longing, and the tremendous power which manifests itself in lust, is a quotation, will create eternal life in order to give it back to those who died. According to Fyodorov, the resurrection of all the dead will mark a complete victory over space and time, and thus the end of history. The general resurrection and a complete liberation from the shackles of a blind, death-dealing nature are mutually dependent. Only a fully united community of humans, including dead ones, is capable of converting all that is nature-given and therefore decrepit into something man-made, artificial, and therefore perfect. Perfection and immortality are ethically justified only when everybody, without exception, can partake of them, whereby injustice and suffering will be annihilated. In this way, Fyodorov eliminates the aporia inherent in all theories of progress. Created by everybody, for everybody, his paradise in this world is a product of the union of all humans in space and time, there being neither the doomed nor victims of history. We see here a drawing by Vasily Chekrygin. Two of his paintings are also on display in our exhibition, showing the process of searching, collecting the particles of the dead ancestors and the beginning of the work of the resurrection of the dead. Chekrygin, who died in 1922, he made a whole series showing the resurrection of the dead. He was deeply impressed by Fyodorov and his philosophy. Fyodorov's followers in post-Soviet Russia presented him as an important religious thinker whose teachings opened up a third phase after the Old and New Testament, that of an active noospheric Christianity, whatever that might be. Especially the reference to humans perfecting the universe led to a misunderstanding of Fyodorov's common task as a connecting link between divine grace and human action, pointing to an active participation of humanity in the divine and human act of the resurrection of the dead and the salvation of the world. However, even though Fyodorov speaks of God's kingdom, Tsarstvo Bozhie, and the realization of divine will, he never mentions divine assistance. Rather, his project is an essentially immanent human scientific and technical one. In his own words, the resurrection will be a task not of miracle, but of knowledge and common labor. Consequently, the need for an otherworldly existence is eliminated. Fyodorov's supermoralism demands, I quote, and you see it here, paradise, the kingdom of God, so not in another world, but in this one. It demands a transformation of our reality here on earth, a transformation that will extend also to all heavenly worlds. The paradise can only be created by people themselves. Fyodorov does speak of a possibility of divine intervention, but only in one case, If humans fail in fulfilling their task, then there is a danger of, I quote Fyodorov, a transcendental resurrection, a resurrection that will be accomplished not by us, but from outside, regardless of and even against our will, a resurrection of wrath, of the last judgment, and a condemnation of some to eternal torments, while others will be doomed to witness these torments. In other words, the apocalyptic prophecies are contingent. Their fulfillment is not irreversible and depends on the behavior of humans. By redeeming themselves and transforming the universe into a paradise, humans can prevent an irate God from destroying the world and dividing humanity forever into those who are redeemed and those who are doomed. Theologians consequently reject Fyodorov's religion of humankind as incompatible with a Christian understanding of sin, death, and redemption. Fyodorov's project resembles most closely the belief in apokatastasis panton, a restitution of all things or universal salvation. This concept, however, is rejected by all Christian confessions as heretical, because it would mean that beginning and end would become one, whereby the historical process of salvation would be deprived of all significance. Boris Groys also spoke about this picture of circularity. So this is also the problem with the apokatastasis panton. The whole creation will be set back into a position before the fall, before the prelapsarian situation. Fyodorov and Russian cosmism. Today, Nikolai Fyodorov is considered to be a founder of the so-called Russian cosmism. Russian cosmism, together with its rapidly increasing number of sub-disciplines such as astrocosmism, theocosmism, sophiocosmism, anthropocosmism, biocosmism, social cosmism, cosmic aesthetics, cosmic ecology, etc., appears to be a blossoming branch of contemporary Russian culture. Adherents define it as, these are all quotes, an original outgrowth of the Russian spirit, an essential element of the Russian idea, and at the same time, one of the greatest discoveries of human culture. The specifically national character of this worldview is said to be rooted in the uniquely Russian archetype of all unity. It is being declared as a basic feature of Russianness, Ruskost, as a Russian way of perceiving life and the world, cosmic, kosmicheski, thereby becomes a mark of everything that is considered truly Russian, from old Russian icons showing the prophet Ilya riding a flaming chariot across the sky right up to space flight of Yuri Gagarin, Russia's son who has paved the way to the cosmos for mankind and who, according to popular belief, went to heaven in his plane crash. Despite the claims of its followers, Russian cosmism, I speak of Russian cosmism, as propagated today is far from being a unified philosophical school or tradition in the sense of an academic history. On the contrary, both the term Russian cosmism and the concept, a hybrid ideological construct, originated in the late Soviet period and has fed into a nationalist discourse about Russian identity in post-Soviet Russia. Russian cosmism is a typical case of the invention of a tradition with the additional intent to support a tradition of invention. The assumption of cosmism, of Russian cosmism as a tradition, is already undermined by the fact that the most important representatives of this tradition in the 20th century did not consider themselves part of an intellectual school of any kind. In addition to that, the differences in their objectives and methods of research, as well in their worldviews, were so fundamental that their works do not contain references to one another. Concerning their relationship to Fyodorov, the alleged founding father of Russian cosmism, there is no evidence of a deeper reception of his work. I would like to demonstrate this on the example of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the autodidact and nearly deaf schoolteacher of physics and mathematics in the then obscure provincial town of Kaluga, the grandfather of Soviet space travel and one of the most prominent representatives of Russian cosmism. Tsiolkovsky's pioneering work in rocketry was inspired by a self-styled cosmic philosophy, a weird bricolage, I wouldn't call it philosophy, of ideas drawn from panpsychism, theosophy, and spiritualism, which he regarded as the work of a genius and redeemer, and did not shy away from comparisons with Jesus Christ, or as he always collegially called him, the teacher from Galilee. Contemporary devotees of Russian cosmism purport time and again that Tsiolkovsky was directly inspired by Fyodorov in his ideas on space travel. Tsiolkovsky's inventions, so they claim, merely served to realize Fyodorov's great visionary design. This view has found its way into Western publications as well. Here we read that Tsiolkovsky took up the course of space flight under the influence of Fyodorov with the aim to bring the awakened ancestors, some even speak of millions of returning souls, to other planets. This is far from truth. Tsiolkovsky's solution of the problem of death, death for him doesn't exist, it is only an illusion of the weak human mind, is completely incompatible with Fyodorov's central idea of personal resurrection by technological means. Whereas Fyodorov's grand project aimed at a restoration of mankind in its entirety and included all deceased people, Tsiolkovsky was solely concerned with the breeding of a future race of superhumans while actively eradicating all inferior beings. It is obvious that neither his cosmic philosophy nor his space projects had anything to do with Fyodorov's common task. What therefore is, you see here a depiction of Tsiolkovsky, which is much more heroic than the one I showed you before. It's also Mifatvorchestvo. What therefore is Russian cosmism? In the years of perestroika, a wave of writings on Russian cosmism brought these ideas enormous popularity. The reasons for this are apparently to be found in a general awareness of an impending crisis, hunger for a compensation for the loss of the empire, a word like Swiss cosmism would be ridiculous, and the need for a theory that assumes the world to be a rational entity with mankind as its center. According to Mikhail Epstein, the breakdown of the Soviet system left behind a metaphysical vacuum. In order to fill it, advocates of Russian cosmism developed the foundations for a new ideocratic regime, a syncretic ideology which combines a number of different key futures. I will name only five, and with that I'm coming to the end of my presentation. What is Russian cosmism? First, para-science. Heliobiologist Alexander Chizhevsky, we heard about him today, is considered one of the main exponents of Russian cosmism in the 20th century. Developed a theory of the impact of cosmic factors on human life and society. his theory of heliotaric, see the influence of this 11 years circle of sun activity. We heard even on the results of British elections. His theory, which shows, I think, obvious connections also with astrology and an occult fascination with prophecy, was never scientifically validated. No wonder Marxist critics condemned his search for what they called a transcendent factor of the historical process as leading to cosmic fatalism. Likewise, considered part of Russian cosmism is Lev Gumilyov's highly speculative biocosmic theory of ethnogenesis, which attempts to explain the origin of ethnic groups and civilizations as the results of spontaneous discharges of a special biochemical energy of cosmic origin. Today's cosmists are doing research on bioenergy, ufology, morphogenetic fields, or try to change the course of time with the aid of Kozyrev's mirrors. Second, I give you just a few examples looking to the 30 minutes I try to keep. Occultism. Second, Russia has been beset by a wave of fascination with the occult for over four decades, or even longer. This wave also carries Russian cosmism. There are many false connections between contemporary cosmists and other groups and movements within the flourishing occult milieu in Russia. Yelena Blavatskaya's Theosophy, a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy, has become a permanent feature of Russian cosmism, as well as the Living Ethics by Yelena and Nikolai Rörich or Daniil Andreev's Rosa Mira. In particular, due to these obvious ties to occultism in both its Eastern and Western variety, Russian cosmism is being fiercely opposed by Orthodox thinkers. The philosopher Nikolai Gavryushin denounced Russian cosmism as a technocratic pseudo-religion and linked it with Western traditions such as Auguste Comte's Religion of Mankind, Masonic Gnosticism, and occult theosophical speculations in order to demonstrate that it was not only incompatible with orthodoxy, but even not of Russian origin. For Alexander Dugin, Russian cosmism is the occult shadow ideology of Soviet Marxism and thereby by part of a world-spanning conspiracy against the Russian people. Third, New Age ideology. Much of the syncretic ideology currently propagated under the label of cosmism appears to be a Russian variant of Western New Age thinking. Since both are rooted in the same traditions of pseudoscientific, utopian, and esoteric thought. Take, for example, the holistic organic conceptions of Fritjof Capra, James Lovelock, or Gregory Bateson. Their works are proof that concepts such as planetarian consciousness, noosphere, ecology of the mind, or the so-called Gaia theory, which takes the Earth to be a living, self-regulating organism, have become standard terminology for both Western New Age ideologists and contemporary Russian cosmists. Fourth, neo-god building. Russian cosmism is also an offspring of Soviet ideology in that it continues trying to connect the pathos of scientism with an all-encompassing sense of meaning of human action. At times, it even appears as a renewed attempt at God-building, Bogostroitelstvo, destined to replace the narrow-minded Marxism of Western origin with an autochthonous meta-religion of superhumanity aiming at a deification of man. Such an attempt had been made by post-industrial patriots a group of prominent Moscow scientists centered around Sergei Kourginian, who propagated a new humanistic religion incorporating allusions to Fyodorov, Théa Desjardins, and Vladimir Vernadsky. In their view, only, I quote, the metaphysics of the common task is capable of conveying to humanity its historic and cosmic mission, overcoming the cosmic absurdity of earthly existence, end of quote. Slavoj Žižek consequently denounced cosmism as, I quote, a strange combination of vulgar materialism and Gnostic spirituality, which formed an occult shadow ideology, the obscene secret teaching of Soviet Marxism, end of quote. And last, finally, speaking of art, which is, after all, our topic here, one can extend to Russian cosmism what Boris Groys once said of the Russian soul. Russian cosmism, and I quote Boris Groys, what he said on the Russian soul, is a commercial strategy used by some to promote themselves in the West as Russian authors, intellectuals, or artists. According to Groys, for somebody seeking to establish themselves here in the West, it is important to define whatever is unique about them and to turn it into a trademark. This is part of intellectual enterprise. The West does not need a westernized Russia, it needs an exotic Russia. Russian cosmism answers this need for exoticism in the best way possible. I'm coming to the end. Russian cosmism elaborates an image of humanity which spreads its noocratic rule over the universe when it can fulfill the universal cosmic plan of turning itself into an almighty and immortal single universal superorganism, thus attaining the status of God. The conjunction between two adjectives, single and universal, is, however, a sign of totalitarian thought. Every great people, Dostoevsky once said, believes and must believe that in it alone lies the salvation of the world. Russian cosmism has become the catchword for yet another Russian doctrine threatening to save the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael Hagemeister, for this wonderful talk and for keeping time. Maybe you wait for a second. If we have one or two urgent questions, I would say we can have them. Is someone there with a microphone?
I'm here. Michael, thank you very much for the provocative presentation. My name is Naum, and well, I'll try to articulate the best in the best possible way my question, which is, it's very interesting to realize that cosmism is a Soviet project, and that we know that they were very disconnected. I mean, Tsiolkovsky acknowledges more Jules Verne than Fyodorov. However, I think that there are some ideas that were resonating between them. Fyodorov was talking about particles, Tsiolkovsky about the atom spirit, and so on. So back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, how were these ideas circulating in Russia? Were they publishing? Were they writing? Were they talking to people about this? Or it was something that it was discovered later and it was put together?
Fyodorov was very reluctant to talk about his philosophy. He didn't allow to publish his writings during his life. He knew that he would be excommunicated by the Orthodox Church. So it was only his followers who published his works in a very low imprint. 480 books were produced at that time. Excuse my poor English. I'm not too used to speak English. So you always hear that Tsiolkovsky was a pupil, a scholar. He was introduced to Fyodorov himself into his philosophy. All we know is that Tsiolkovsky himself, he said he discovered Fyodorov's philosophy many, many years after Fyodorov's death. And all his work shows that there was no real influence. His atom theory, it was a panpsychism, was very popular at that day. Not only Ernst Haeckel, but also there was a whole school of Russian panpsychists. So he took these ideas of the besold and atom, he took it from other sources. And it's very alien to Fyodorov. Fyodorov is a pure materialist and has no use for happy atoms and their lives. And so it's, if you read Tsiolkovsky, I wonder how one can compare Fyodorov and Tsiolkovsky, and especially Tsiolkovsky's attitude toward death. Death is a pure illusion. It doesn't exist. No, the atom wanders from one incarnation to another, to another, to another. And this is completely incompatible with Fyodorov. As far as I know, there was no much communications between the so-called cosmists. In Vladimir Vernadsky, I do not find any trace of a reception of Fyodorov. I wondered when I saw this table here, and I saw the Fladensky. How can one call Fladensky a cosmist? I mean, in the sense of Fyodorov or even Tsiolkovsky. So they put people and concepts together under the label of cosmism. Sorry, as a historian, I cannot follow.
Who is they?
Sorry?
Who is they?
It's the advocates of Russian cosmism. I must stress, artists are absolutely free in creating myths, but I am a historian. I go to the sources, and sorry, for me, Russian. I can give you the name of the Russian philosopher who invented, or he claimed to have invented, the term of Russian cosmism. It's Fyodor Gerenok. In the 1970s. The term Russian cosmism appears, as far as I know, for the first time in the last volume of Philosophskaya Encyclopedia in 1970. Before that date, the term Russian cosmism, as it is propagated today, doesn't exist. And Vernadsky, Chizhevsky, they didn't call them. Tsiolkovsky called himself a biocosmist. And there was, of course, cosmism in the 1920s. There was this movement of biocosmists. And so that's interestingly, the biocosmists are usually not taken into the tradition of Russian cosmism. It's
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. I think it's a question of close reading and generalizing. So,
deformation professionnelle historian has another attitude.
I think we'll get back to that in the end of our panel when we discuss the positions of all three speakers. Is there another question? We have time
urgent
for
question.
A second urgent, concrete question to this talk. Yes, I see one hand. There's a microphone.
I don't know much. I don't know anything about the topic of cosmism, and I listened to Boris Gross and now here. But I was wondering how the different thinkers, especially the last that you described, that talked about, let's say, the return of atoms without death, as an illusion, death as an illusion. I was wondering how some or many cosmists handled the hypothesis that a singularity of the individual is an illusion, and that we basically are made of the same unit, like a water drop, for example, but only the instant appearance would differ from one drop to the next. But for example, the amount of water atoms would be the same per drop, and each generation would just come up with the illusion of singularity, individual singularity, that might disappear at death. But actually, technically, it's just the same consciousness that reappears and things, you know? How did they handle this?
Yeah, you shouldn't speak about cosmos. You should ask, how did Fyodorov, for example, solve this problem, or how did Tsiolkovsky solve? Because the solutions are very, very different.
Yeah.
I think for Fyodorov, this was a big problem. It's a problem for theologians who believe in physical resurrections as well. I mean, if you as a Christian believe in physical resurrections, the whole problem of identity becomes urgent. And what's about, Solovyov asked a question, what's about cannibalism? What's about a person who has devoured another person? Who will be resurrected? If you incorporate another person, this person becomes part of you, and then one has to decide. You see the problem. It was also a problem for Christian thinkers, for Augustine. He asked, what's about hair? What's about nails? You lose during your life, and will they become part of the resurrected body, and things like that. So Fyodorov tries to solve this problem. He said resurrection will take place continually. First you resurrect your fathers, then their fathers, they will resurrect other people, and the materia, the matter, is sufficient in the whole universe. Therefore, you have to travel to the universe in order to find the particles of your ancestors, which are scattered through the whole universe. And it's not only to make the universe a place for the resurrected ancestors, but first you have to conquer the universe in order to get all these particles. You remember the drawing by Chick Reagan. One is looking into the universe and searching for the particles of the ancestors. And as it is a gradually resurrection, matter will be sufficient to accomplish this deed.
Okay, now I have to be strict. Thank you very much again, Michael Hagemeister, for this wonderful talk. Maybe you want to take this with you.